In this episode of the Stamina Lab podcast, I spoke to Dr. Hassan Alim. Hassan is an expert in neuroaesthetics, and his research focuses on how we learn and change preferences over time and the role of aesthetics in social identity. Hassan has contributed to product development and strategy in diverse sectors like biometric wearables, fintech, and pharmaceuticals. He's currently advising companies on behaviorally informed product strategy at Nuance. During this episode, we talk about how our brain uses what we find as beautiful to give us an approach signal to learn more, basically driving our attention. Given this insight, we discuss how creating your environment with this mindset helps create the conditions for a mental state of more flow in your work, with the people you interact with, and of course, how you better create the conditions for restorative sleep, which, as we know, improves everything. In fact, Hassan shares when you see something beautiful, your brain feels safe, which can help reduce stress, reducing cortisol, and allowing your brain time to recover. Engaging in these activities results in a 31% lower risk of dying from all-cause mortality. An incredible result for a zero-cost way to improve your health span. After this episode, you'll walk away with strategies on how to use neuroaesthetics to open up your mind for exploration and growth. I know you'll get a lot out of this conversation, so let's get started. Welcome to the newest episode of Stamina Lab, hosted by me, Glenn Lubert. If you're ready to upgrade your performance, achieve mental clarity, and improve your well-being, well, then you're in the right place. You'll hear the stories of professionals who have taken on big challenges while managing their energy and longevity through the ups and downs of pursuing their goals. Enjoy this episode, then head to the show notes to learn more so you can take the next steps to build the habits and systems you need to achieve your dreams. All right, welcome to the show, Hassan.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So tell me about the kids' connection between beauty and aesthetics and the considerable connection to how we make choices.
Yeah, I think that really goes to why I decided to study this topic, because, you know, it can sometimes feel a little bit like beauty is this esoteric thing. You go to the art museum and that's it, and it doesn't really have an impact in your day-to-day. But when you start to come down to it, a lot of, you know, what catches our attention, what's salient to us, information is being told to us by one thing or another is all coming through aesthetic components, and that ends up shaping our choice. And it's that loop where the more you pick something and the more you pay attention to something, the more you start to notice details about it, and those details communicate through aesthetics attributes of that object, right? So you might notice, you might be put onto like a type of cereal by your friend, and you'll notice some things about it. But next time, that's our brain works in statistical ways, right? So we'll notice something that's in a similar aesthetic space as whatever that packaging is like, more likely to catch our attention. And we know that whatever is more likely to catch our attention is more likely to have our choice. So I kind of see these as like a, you know, almost like a chicken and the egg. It's like, what came first, like the choice or what caught your attention, which is the aesthetics part. But it's almost like they're both in this like virtuous cycle.
And the example of the cereal box is another example that you can give that shows this type of idea.
Yeah. So just in terms of like how choice is made, or how do you?
Yeah. Make? How the aesthetics influence it. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think I think there's components that you can break it down to. In my research, like, we broke it down to like symmetry, right? So symmetry, the color, the contrast, the balance, all those components are there. So that ends up shaping choice in terms of where our eyes are being tracked to, and what our brain is designed to appreciate, right? So there are certain things that we have a symmetry detection center in our brain that is specialized for mostly for our faces, but it also ends up being incredibly useful for most things.
Okay.
Most things that are symmetrical, right? Most things that are alive are symmetrical. And what you generally find is that things that we find beautiful are also tend to be matching with natural functions that our brain is designed for, right? So fractality, for example, like we like things that have that thing within a thing nature, which is comes from nature, and our brain is really used to that type of structural processing. So when it comes to like choice, oftentimes, like in, even in studies, you'll find this where artists will be deploying a lot of like, when you look down at it, artists will be deploying natural scene statistics in their paintings that don't even have to do anything with nature, because that's just what catches our attention. Mm. So, you know, like, yeah, in terms of everyday choice, I think it's just about whatever resembles those things, right? Like whatever ends up looking like most of those things. And what we end up finding is that most things that we like, most things that catch our attention and we'd like to have around or prefer in some way or another have those attributes. And this comes to this theory called the processing fluency theory. Fluency, I don't know if you're familiar with that term.
In general, fluency.
Yes.
You're fluent in language, yeah. You're fluent in a topic, yeah.
Yeah, so fluency in this case is like what is easy for our brain to process, right? Like what does it have the maximum capability to process? What are the structures anatomically coded in it? So things that are fluent also tend to be, are things that, you know, like I said, symmetry, all those things are natural colors that exist more commonly than other colors. Those end up being more easily processed, requiring less metabolic power. And that actually ends up being what's the attractive option, or at least the more, you know, preferred option, because it took, our brains are lazy, right?
Right.
So less energy means just like
more efficiency,
more fluency. Yeah, exactly. So,
oh, interesting. So yeah. It's going through, looking for things that are like you said, the face, is that looking at faces? Is that what you're saying before?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, our vision center is this hierarchical, right? So it starts from small to more and more complex features. But one of the mid-level areas is symmetry. And the idea there is like, you know, faces are incredibly important for recognition. We even have a face area in our brain. So just having symmetry as an indicator of that. And then also biological movement. Like you want to be able to tell apart what's an animal that's coming at you, or what's something that's present, that's alive, usually tends to move in symmetrical ways, has symmetry. So it's just profound, you know, abundance of that. So therefore, there's a lot of processing power devoted to that, meaning that like we'll like it when it appears, right? So it's sort of now when you go on PowerPoint and you're like, oh, you know, this kind of looks off. Uh-huh. Like, why does it have to be, right? There's no rule telling you that, like, you know, when you really think about it, yeah, it's like, why does it matter? But it's just because it looks off, because we're used to, it's just easier to process information when it's in that format, because that's what our brains are designed to do. So it's that, you know, sort of bottom up that is shaping those decisions at the higher level.
That's really interesting. So it's basically energy management, which is what our bodies are trying to be efficient with its energy.
Yeah, totally.
So it goes into the connection with looking at your attention.
Yeah.
And the chicken and egg type thing I think is interesting, because, you know, we're driven by what drives our attention, and we're in an attention economy. So what I'm hearing, though, is if you use these aesthetic rules, you're more likely to be able to connect with people's attention.
Do you strive to boost your energy, focus, creativity, and flow while keeping burnout at bay? Then Stamina Lab Sleep and Recovery Coaching Program is tailored just for you. At Stamina Lab, we believe sleep isn't just a nice to have. It's a sophisticated performance tool and the foundation for unparalleled daily energy and creativity. Through the fusion of behavior design, cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, and nervous system management, we provide you with personalized, data-driven insights to construct lasting sleep habits and sleep confidence. Abandon the trial and error of self-guided apps and caffeine fixes. It's time to unlock a sharper mind, stronger body, and steadier emotional balance through expert one-on-one human coaching. Take the first step towards mastering the science and art of sleep and recovery. Download your free Sleep Interruptions Wake and Recovery Guide by visiting sleep.staminalab.io. Reshape your nights to transform your days. Embrace yourself for a remarkable journey to enhance cognitive function, resilience, and stamina at sleep.staminalab.io.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a fundamental component there that I think connects all this, which is that what is what is aesthetics, right? Like, what is something that is pleasing to you? It's a signal, right? So there's a great theory or a paper that describes this theory called like stopping for knowledge hypothesis, which basically means that what is it something that's beautiful when you're out and about or just anything that you see, like something that catches attention, what is it telling you to do? When you think about it in terms of survival terms, like it's catching your attention, but what is it actually trying to do? It's getting you to, it's telling you some information, it's inviting you to explore. So the idea is that like it's an approach signal. Beauty and aesthetics are an approach signal, which tell you, look, there's information and a potential payoff to be learned here. Some really interesting, you know, work that's been building off that theory and the idea is that like, you know, when you create environments that are more aesthetic pleasing, you actually can put people into states where they're more willing to explore and more willing to be in that state where they are, as opposed to a state that's not telling them to approach, right? So I think this really is that when you think about like, why do things catch our attention? It's usually because we expect some sort of a payoff, right? Some sort of, and it leads to action, right? The attention leads to action. So the idea here, the way I like to think about it is that it's like aesthetics is this stylized compression of information that's saying, look, like there's something to be, there's something of value here. You should come and explore this area, or there's a lot to be explored in this versus something else.
And this is why is this important for an individual to understand?
Yeah. So I think it's, that's a great question. And I think it's important because there's two ways to go about it. Like one is important to think about it in terms of how are you leading your life in terms of your mindset, right? So there's some really cool work on thinking about like, can you approach things with an aesthetic mindset? And that sort of sounds funny when you think about it first, but it really is true. When you put people in a scanner and you ask them to just look at something versus look at something from an aesthetic mindset, our brain acts differently, right? We actually have a different state of how we're absorbing and processing that information. And the reason is because we are in a more exploratory state when we're in that mindset, right? So it's really relevant for everyday individuals to think about like how often am I in that state in a daily period, right? Like it's sort of comes to like the fight or flight, but more so in terms of like the explore versus exploit thing that's more common, let's say in like machine learning algorithms, but it's also really important in terms of growth, right? So when you start thinking about what does growth mean? Growth means that you start to explore your environment, you start to be open and process what's around you. And you're more open to those things, whereas exploit is like, you know, you found something that works, you're just going to stick to your daily routine, you're going to do exactly that, you're not going to try to branch out. So the idea is that like being in that aesthetic mindset, opening yourself up to aesthetic experiences, allows you to be more in that mindset that's conducive to growth.
Is this, then connect more, your brain would be more, have more neuroplasticity in that state? Is it connected to novelty?
Yeah, it's definitely connected to novelty. It's like openness to novelty, I would say, almost, right? Yeah. Like, so like, how open are you to be surprised, basically, right? So that's like, there's interesting stuff where people that have high openness to experience trait, you know, in terms of the big five, they end up being generally more involved in aesthetic activities, but it also goes the other way. The more you become involved in aesthetic experiences, the more you do that, you actually end up being more open to experience in general to other things in your life, and your personality in that like has that impact on it. So yeah, I think there is definitely that novelty and like openness to novelty, right? Like how willing are you to accept uncertainty into your life? Because when you think about it, like, you know, the certain thing to do is like to go to the exact same place that gave you the calories, that gave you the answer, and keep doing that over and over. Trying something else is uncertain, but it also means a potential for going to the next level, right? Getting that growth, and the idea being that aesthetics invites you to take that risk a little bit, if you think about it.
And then it feeds back on itself, where you would be more willing to do it more?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. I think that's one of the coolest parts about this, I think, is that, you know, like adopting that mindset is self, like a virtuous cycle, it's self-supportive. Just simply saying, there's studies that show that, like, you know, simply going to visit an art museum, but it doesn't have to be that, you know, just as an example, like even once or twice a month puts people in a state that they're differently involved in terms of like their attitude. It predicts, in college students, it predicts their social well-being later on in life. It predicts like their robustness of their identity also, right? So like you're more involved, hence your identity is a little bit more robust because it's not just based on one specific thing, right? You're open to uncertainties in the world and you've sort of adapted different parts where somebody who's stuck in that routine might not have. So it does definitely feed into that. And I think when you ask people about their growth, you often notice that there is that, like, you know, it's that repeated cycle. Like they start engaging in something, and then like I did this because, well, I tried something else once and it was fun, so I tried this thing now. I took another risk, right? So definitely help support that.
And so when you create that cycle and you that increased identity, that more complex identities or set of identities, I guess, allows you to be more resilient, I'd imagine, then too, as well, because if something is not, and as an entrepreneur, I know, and this is one of the things I give a lot of advice to young entrepreneurs is your entire existence is not this company. But you kind of have to play the, it's going to play the jiu-jitsu and be like, okay, I got to put all in on this in order to make this thing happen. But at the same time, you can't let it all be your identity, because then if negatively there's a failure, then you you are the failure rather than that piece. So so what I'm gathering here is that by being more aesthetic minded would help in that use case, but in general for any type of failure that you would come across or challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's because it comes back to self-reflection, right? So one of the things that when you're in that mindset, like you are opening yourself and dedicating that space to say, like, look, I'm going to stop and, you know, literally smell the roses, right? Like look up and see the sky, or just appreciate like the room that we're in right now, like notice things that I wouldn't have noticed otherwise. And what that does is it's not just floating by, that's being incorporated into different factors of yourself and your being, and it's self-reflective, right? So when people are in that aesthetic mindset, when you put them in a fMRI scanner where you're seeing like where their brain areas are acting up, when they're in an aesthetic mindset, the default mode network lights up, and that has to do with self-reflection and understanding where you are and your place in the world. This is the same area that lights up when people are in psychedelics, right? So it's like it's that same fundamental process that people always attribute to in terms of growth is like, who am I? It allows you to step back. So when you think about it that way, like it definitely goes back to like, you know, that a little bit being more resilient because you've gone through that self-reflective process.
Right. Also then, since you're tapping into the default mode network there, then too, also help from a productivity standpoint if you like, try to get into flow states more often, I guess, right?
Yeah. That's a really cool point that I would love to explore that where, you know, like depending on how you design your room, right? For example, the way the orientation we're sitting here, like the greenery in the background that we're in, I think how does that shape essentially your mindset, right? Like there's things that we know in behavioral science shows that like, you know, your environment shapes and generally your expectations, which shapes your mindset and how you approach things and how you process things. So there is definitely a really interesting idea to be explored there for getting into that flow state, right? Like being in a place where you feel like you're in that reflective mode versus being in a space that you're not. And maybe aesthetics is a cool part of that to be able to set that aside.
And so you talked a little bit about how the aesthetics and identity are connected. I don't know if you see a little bit more about that and then how in general is identity shaped. We talked about a little bit how if you get into this mindset, you are allowed to have a more robust identity, but how do we shape our identity with aesthetics?
Yeah, I think so. It's a great question. And I think this really comes from this was sort of the second half of my research career where I really got interested in this question about identity and the role, like the social component of aesthetics, right? And before that, I'd done a lot of work on like, what am I as a person one to one processing this? But like now, what am I as a person as a part of a society? What am I signaling to other people as far as like, what do my aesthetic choices, what I decide to wear, what I decide to decorate my house with, and what do other people do? What is that signaling to me and vice versa? And what this work really shows is that like experiments show, for example, that like when people imagine that their aesthetics taste change, they actually end up imagining themselves as a different person compared to like, let's say they're, you know, something also profound, like their religion changing or their political affiliation changing or their, you know, something we consider fundamental. And you'd think like, okay, yeah, we all know that we all change over time. Like my taste changed. But when people are asked to imagine like, hey, imagine that you went from liking this type of art to this type of art, people actually see that as, oh, I must be a very different person then, because that's two different people, right? So what I see it as like in terms of identity is that it's both a signal to oneself and it's reflective to other people as well. So it's a way for us to understand where I am And it connects to identity because, again, I think it really comes back to information. Like it's, I keep coming back to this, that the aesthetics is that stylized, compressed, stylized transfer of information, right? So I can sit here and tell you, like, these are my moral values, these are my this values, or you can just hear a little bit about like the things that I like and things that I don't like and things that I like to create and I don't. And that'll tell you a lot about that because I'm giving that information in a more implicit way, which is how social communication wise, like identity works that way, right? There's, we don't like to just tell everybody like, yes, I donate and I do this. Like we want to signal that I donate through some other mean,
right?
And aesthetics is a great way to do that. So it's a really, really like well fit medium for talking about identity.
And that would essentially would also include your, how you, what you wear, your fashion, be a part of that, correct?
Yeah. And you know, I this is something that have definitely given more importance to in terms of like the fashion industry itself, right? And what does that mean? Like self-expression. And of course, like, you know, it's not that everybody has to dress like, you know, you should judge somebody completely because of how they dress or anything like that. But there is that idea of how do people perceive you in terms of like more so like how you decide, what choices do you make, right? Like, so what is valuable to you? Even people that say like, oh yeah, I'm, you know, I'm going against the grain, I'm not doing anything. You're still communicating that that's still a choice.
Yeah.
It's just the opposite choice, right? There's that's social, sort of the social paradox of identity is that you can't escape it. You know, like no identity is an identity in itself. You're choosing to be anti-conformist or anything like that. And that's still a signal. If you decide to, you know, like be like me and be like, not do your hair as much.
Yeah.
That's still telling something. It's a choice, right? So just being more mindful of like, that's great. That doesn't mean you have to change that. Just like, just being more confident of that and understanding what that means.
Yeah. You're signaling, oh, this is just not important to me. Whatever that you're fixing your hair every day.
The social construct of it. Yeah.
It's not that important to you. So you spend your time elsewhere.
Yeah.
And the intention, you basically, it's about intentionality. Intentionality here is that you're saying just by being aware of it, you have then made a more robust identity again by just understanding that, hey, by not doing this, I'm actually signaling something in my identity as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to, ascertain, you know, the thought of how much, you know, paying attention to your aesthetics, and being more mindful of it. And even if you aren't being intentional about it, I mean, it's kind of a, like you said, the paradox is like I'm not someone who's particularly, aware of my aesthetics, but at the same time, that's also a signal of my knowledge. How would you say someone can go about building their aesthetic choices?
Yeah, just incorporating it more into their life, right? Like,
yeah,
I think it doesn't have to be, you know, again, it doesn't have to be that you have to go to a museum, right? And I think that's what it really is more so about, it comes back to attention, right? So I think I always come back to, that's the fundamental cognitive thing that the whole game is really about, is like, where are you paying attention and what are you noticing and what is that process leading you to? So just the idea being that one, like being in a mindset where like you're going on a walk where you're saying like, I'm going to notice things and reflect on them in terms of what they mean to me. Do I like them? Do I not like them? You know, what stands out to me? And that helps you in navigating the world the next time, right? So you notice deeper things. And I think that's the whole point of this journey aspect here that comes in here, is that like, it's not, you're not the same person that goes, if once you start that journey of that mindset, like you go further and further along. And the way I like to think about it is that there's endless meaning to be found in the world, right? So when you look at experts that are experts in, you know, a specific material, a part, or like, you know, specific type of wood making, right? They've gone to that because of that level of meaning, and I could just walk by it and never notice it, right? So through engagement, through that mindset of like noticing noticing, it's a cycle of noticing and self-incorporating, right? So how much of that do I actually want to understand and learn from and have it become like a part of my thought process and impact me, like, oh, this is cool. I want to be into, you know, woodworking now, or I want to be into planting now, or I want to be into like this method or this thing now, or astronomy, right? Noticing that you can get further and further, and it's like it's a way to get meaning. And that's what I think, that's essentially what, when you think about it, that's what's happening in an art museum in a curated way, right? So it's like a prompt. I think of artworks or these things as a prompt to be like, well, we've put you in a state where like you're more likely to, if you put in that mindset, you're going to reflect and get some type of meaning out of it, because the artist had got meaning out of it and they're trying to convey that to you. But you can do that in everyday life. You can do that every time you go on a walk, every time you're, you know, like working out, and you could either be on your phone or you could just look at how things around you are made, right? And try to understand and appreciate. And you know, next time you'll notice a little bit more.
And so by taking note of that, what you're attracted to or what you find beauty in, that then informs, you know, how you can perhaps create it in your own home, or in your own creation of your area, your design of your environment as well. So what you're saying though is every time you go and do this, you're getting a more robust aesthetic knowledge.
Yeah, exactly. It's that you know, it's sort of updating your model, right? I think mm-hmm. that's the way I like to think about it, is that you know, going back to the exploring aspect, you being willing to explore is being willing to update your model of the world and mm-hmm. say like, look, it, you know, I want to update it and I want new information coming in. So yeah, that's definitely part of it. And as far as like incorporating it in your life, I think making those choices in a directed way then, right? To say like, look, I want to curate my experience so that I want to be in this space more often. So that might be like, you know, in your house, creating an area where you only sit down and you want to be in a specific mindset that you know, this is the only place that I'm going to go and reflect if when I need to do that. I don't do any other activity here, and it's designed for that, right? Or in your food choices, right? So like, I think this is an important thing that I have a little one that I always try to actually like explore, is that like presenting things in a nicer way, even to yourself though. Like, you know, you could, I'm trying to eat healthy, we're all trying to eat healthy. And there's two ways to do it is one is just like, you know, put that food, a salad on there. But like, if you intentionally design it, if you design it to be appealing to you, and as if you were about to present it to somebody else, but then it's for you, I think you'll notice that there's just a greater sense of appeal there, and there's a greater sense of wanting to engage. And you find this in terms of like, you know, people's appetite, like, you know, how like you can make things that maybe not are as appetizing or attractive to you. Mm-hmm. But once you start that process, like you actually then again are in that cycle where like, you start to appreciate it more, and you're more likely to share it, right? You're more likely to not just hide it because it's, you find something ugly. Like, you're like, look what I made this. Like, I'm going to share this on Instagram, or yeah. I'm going to do this, right? And we see that all the time. Like, people, the healthy foods that are aesthetic have taken off a lot more than healthy foods that are not aesthetic, right? For that reason. So
the point you made about having this robust language about, or knowledge of, as you keep going through this journey. Yeah. There's a couple of times I keep thinking about, the theory of constructed emotion from Lisa Feldman Barrett, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. where your brain predicts, you know, how you're going to feel and see, and the more robust of a emotional language you could have, the more variety you can have in that, and allows you to be more resilient and flexible as things. And so I keep coming back to it because it sounds really similar to here. The more aesthetic of a language or knowledge you have, the more robust you can have your environment and your ideals. So do you see a connection there? Is that
absolutely? And I think I don't know if she uses this, but I think the way I like to think about it is like assimilation, right? Mm-hmm. I think there's I think it's Eckelman, or there's somebody who has this idea of like the theory of assimilation, which is that like as you go out, like you there's some things that you assimilate in terms of like you process and you understand and you assimilate that in terms of your world model. And there's other things that, you know, you let them flow by because we have to, you can't process everything. So you make those choices. And the idea being that, you know, the more that you engage in a certain way, first of all, you're open to assimilating more when you're in that mindset, right? That's the biggest thing. And the second being that, like, when you're open to it, as you assimilate more, your ability to assimilate more in that direction goes. So it's like a corkscrew, right? Is the way I think about it, is like you're able to assimilate more and more depth in terms of that area. So you're able to get richness of experience, like more meaning. And like that emotion, it might be the same in terms of like what it appears, but in terms of what it means to you and how much it is integrated might be more different depending on like how assimilated that idea is to you, right? Like if that's something that's a core part of your identity, right? Like, you know, this aesthetic component, like the way I design this or the way I reflect this, like this reflects who I am. That has layers and layers of meaning. Whereas you can also do that by just saying like, oh, I like that person's style. I'm just going to copy it. It's still nice. It still makes you feel good. But you haven't really had that journey of getting to that point and the values that are behind it, right? So it's that sort of, and you see that all the time, you know, like everybody likes to sort of be in a, you know, if somebody has a nice style or somebody is designed their environment in a nice way, like, you know, you see this interior design, right? Trends come and go. But those that, for example, have the farmhouse, I worked with an interior designer, like those actually grew up in a farmhouse, probably appreciate like and can understand a much deeper sense of meaning from the farmhouse aesthetic than those that only saw it in a magazine are now designing. And then like next year, they're gonna be like, this is ugly now.
Right.
Because you never had that connection, right? So like you never built it. So it wasn't robust in that sense. You didn't assimilate it. It worked at a more superficial level. It still worked. You know, that's the nice thing is that these things work, but there's unlocked value that you can still get to.
You get further down the journey.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If you're willing to. Yeah.
The work we do a lot of is with helping people improve their sleep and just so they get more energy and focus and resilience so they can do all the things they want to do for in their lives. And getting into a sleep state, getting into a state is a state. And so it's not, you can't obviously just turn the switch on it. And I think that's one of the things that's really a part of the journey, the process as we help people do that. And really one of the key things, you said before, this is my one area where I can just go and I'll be contemplative or meditate or whatnot. The same thing with the bedroom, you know, like this is create this space just for sleep and have it be a cocoon of for you that, if you're splurge in anything, you get your nice sheets, get the nice candle in there to make that environment. That's essentially what you're doing is you're trying to build that aesthetic too as well for your sleep as well. I'm now processing this is a way to frame this is to get that aesthetic right for your calmness, your serenity.
Absolutely. And I think it's an like first of all, it's an approach signal, right? It tells you
approach signal, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think it's very much like you want places that you want you would like to be more often. You want to make them appealing and beautiful so that you're more likely to approach them. And then the second part is like the way you design it then shapes like what you do in that environment, right? But first of all, though, I think it's very much like are you designing your environment in a way? Where you sleep, is that in a way that encourages you to approach and it feel like, okay, this is where I want to be versus like, you know, this is where I have to be. Like, this is where you're okay. It's end of the day. I have to go to sleep. Like, this is just like a cot, right? Like,
right.
You know, as opposed to like, obviously doing the best with what you can in terms of like, you know, what you have available to you, but putting that effort there, same with work, same with anything. But I think, sleep is especially interesting because I think it's that thing where, you know, you a lot of people don't necessarily pay that much attention because like, I'm going to have my eyes closed. Why do I need this to look nice? Or like, you know, I'm just going to be sleeping, but it's like, you want to be able to look forward to that. Right. Like you want something like that to be, just like a fundamentally, like making like a heat map, like it should be something that where you want to be versus at night, you know, things and your environment should ideally change where like, you know, sitting outside in front of the TV or anything like that, like that's a less inviting environment than, you know, where you should be at night. So like you can do that in really interesting ways nowadays with technology, like using Hue, right?
Yeah.
So you can like shape things so that they're just more attuned to their environment and that's where you're going to be sleeping. And it's like just set up in a more, more conducive way there.
Yeah, the Hue lights is what you're referring
yes,
to.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, and I think even the way they do those Hue lights, I think it's almost, the lighting options are all are environments that you're trying
yes,
to, they're aesthetic environments that you're trying to a pick there in the options. It's interesting. I like that. Now it's the approach signal. I really like that term to connect with, to, you know, changing your behavior. Is how do you create approach signals?
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to ask about more. I want to go back again to identity again. In Atomic Habits, James Clear, you know, says that, you know, and a lot of people have read the book, that's why I mentioned it, but that true behavior change is identity change. And how do you identify identity transformation? Mm-hmm. How do you define that?
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously identity is so many things, and it's part of that is just like how, I think it does really, a big part of it comes down to what information you're putting out there in the world. So, you know, one of the ways that I think about it, like the analogy of the sailboat analogy that Scott Barry Kaufman has, is in terms of like identity and self-actualization. That's that trajectory of growth, right? So knowing that, you know, where do I want to end up? Like, what port do I want to go to? That's like, metaphorically, you can imagine that as, like, okay, I now have changed because I have come here. Like, I was aiming in that direction and I ended up here. My identity has changed. I've self-actualized to this spot. But how do you understand that? What I would add to that is it's almost like your aesthetic choices and your components and what you listen to, what you watch, what you appreciate, what you pay attention to. Those are all essentially like a flag that you have on your sailboat, right? So like, these are flags that you're putting up and saying like, look, this is the direction that I'm going and this is where I'm currently at, right? Like, this is what I'm exploring and this is where I'm headed. So I see identity transformation when I look back, like, at my journey, at seeing like the continuous journey of transforming. It's obviously values, it's obviously like self-actualization and improving, but it's also how that has shaped like the way that I approach the things that I engage with. And in that sense, like, I'm talking about just not just like, you know, I think basically what things do I find beautiful? What things do I find worthy of attention? I think that has changed, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that to me is as a way of signaling is like, you know, hey, I want to be in state Y, and people in state Y like those types of things. And oftentimes, like, a social shortcut is to just start doing those things, right? And then you fake it till you make it and you get there, right? And that does work, right? Because, again, because of that, you know, the more you pay attention, the more it can work, right? But the natural way to end up there is to go on these trajectories, right? Where you start to like the things that are similar in that direction and it leads you into that directory. And the trajectory being like how that sailboat, where that's going.
You'd be more open to do this change if, like what you're saying before, is if you continue to pay attention to beauty and aesthetics, that opens you up more to this ability to change.
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, obviously, it's not the only component, right? There's many other factors, but I think, you know, I do think it's a fundamental component because of like the central idea of exploring that we were talking about earlier, mm-hmm. is that, you know, this openness, this self-reflection process, like, these are all what I consider and are these key components of like, okay, I want to grow. What do I have to do that? To grow, I have to explore what's around me. To grow, I have to then reflect on what that meant to me. And aesthetic experiences allow you to do that. They're fundamental to that. So I think that's why, like, it's not the only thing, but it's certainly getting you in that mindset where, like, you're more ready to do that. As opposed to the other part, like, you know, the alternative, for example.
That makes it why that the Scott Barry Kaufman's interpretation of Maslow's work as a sailboat is also fitting, because you're, you know, exploring on the seas.
When I was first read that, I was like, oh, this is interesting, because, you know, like, it really goes to that explorer, like, you know, part of it is like, you know where you want to be, but also like, it's also being open to, like, you know, what else is available to you, right? Just like being willing to put the sail up, right? And I think, and put the sail up and put it wide, right? Like, you know, I don't know all the sailing terms. Sorry for anybody who was like, you know, that's not what you say. But, you know, like, basically, like, being more open to the winds of change, letting you take where you are.
Yeah.
versus like, okay, I'm going to put it up a little bit and like, you know, I'm just going to stay here. Like, right. I think that the explore mindset is crucial.
Yeah. I mean, I love that metaphor for lots of reasons. And I like how you have added, you know, the little flags on that piece for where you're signaling you're going to go or your aesthetic preferences, I guess. Yeah. The piece I really like about that metaphor, though, is that at some points you do want to have that sail all the way out. If you can, that's if you get to that point. But sometimes there's a storm that comes, mm-hmm. and you want to pull that sail. You need to pull that sail in to steady the boat, mm-hmm. to get those base needs taken care of. So the idea of keeping that though that aesthetic mindset even when you're in those base needs, I think it goes back to the resilience. I think will allow you to get through that storm faster. Just me thinking out loud.
That's a really interesting idea. I think really interesting, like whether, you know, what should you do in this state? Like, what does that mean to have that mindset, the openness to aesthetic stimuli, that component, like in a mindset where you're not ready to open your sail, right?
Yeah.
And what does that mean? I think, part of it is like, yeah, definitely that you not only have that surface level meaning for one, so like you have breadth and depth there. Right? I think that's the nice part about it, is that like there's meaning that we've talked about in terms of like you're able to really hone on to something and say like, well, you know, like I have certain hobbies that like that have led me, like, you know, I mentioned woodworking because that's one of them. It's that like whenever things are not working in other areas of life, like that's something that I can just go and watch other people make, or I can appreciate how something is made whenever I walk into a room, no matter how my life is going. Right. So it sort of is like almost like in some sense, a free lunch, because you have attention. It's like every waking moment you have the ultimate resource that mm-hmm. we have as humans is attention, right? And like, you know, there's really interesting philosophy around this as well. Is like, you know, that is the most generous thing that we can offer anybody and anything is our attention. And we have it all the time, every waking moment. So how can you structure that so you actually get the most out of it, rather than it being something that drags you in every which way that's not, you know, meaningful to you in some way or another, right? So you can... one person who hasn't been in that mindset doesn't really like, you know, this plant here, I'm not familiar with it, but somebody who's been gardening has these plants, mm-hmm. they will give it the same level of attention as they walk in as me, that split second, but they'll get meaning out of it, which I didn't, right? So it's right. About like hone the crafts that you're in and notice when those things are out there, like be in that mindset. And it, in some sense, like no matter what state of life you're in, you're getting that out of it. You're getting meaning. And I think that's truly like, you know, one antidote to being in those situations where there's a storm or where right. you're alone or anything, like, you know, the meaning can still be there.
Yeah. And then obviously that would help with your mental health, real easily by having that mindset, because you're finding meanings is a great way to, pull yourself out of that, any type of mental challenge you're having.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think geriatric populations, for example, you know, like the loneliness epidemic that, you know, we're facing, I think there's some really interesting, I hope that it gets explored more in terms of like, you know, what is that, how can we provide support to like, you know, that meaning making a little bit more by being in a different mindset.
Yeah. How do you train for this?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, I certainly, I'm not an artist, but I think if I had to say, like, the way it's not, it's essentially no, like training yourself in the art of noticing, right? So I think,
because it's not, you don't have to be an artist.
No,
I feel like that's a really clear distinction. Like, we're not talking about being an artist, or just like you say, it's just noticing.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, well, a shortcut to it is like, you know, one thing that we're just prone to noticing is nature, right? So going back to like what mm-hmm. our brain finds fluent. Is that just being in environments that are, you know, naturally are going to be like that. And then art museums and all these things, like music that is, you know, live performance, or just even listening to music in that mindset can put you in a self-reflective state. So it can allow you to notice. But I think truly it's just sticking to something that you're creating, right? I think that's a great way to do it. So like creating something allows you to notice. I think one of my favorite sayings that it comes from an article title is that reality has a lot more detail than you think. And I think that's so true once you start building something, once you start creating something. And that's synonymous with self-actualization, right? I think it's like one of those fundamental core activities that, like, you know, nowadays, like a lot of work, for example, what I do is also all about like thought leadership and all that stuff, but also like just actually creating with your hands or watching somebody create that, or you know, whether it's cooking, whether it's doing something.
Right.
Like, if I'm cooking something, I try to make a dish, and then I go and have a dish that the same dish that some a renowned chef made, I'm going to notice things that no matter how much I read about it, I'm never going to be able to notice otherwise. Right. So that assimilation component really is a skill, and then skill comes from doing. So unfortunately, there's like, you know, obviously there's no shortcuts, right? There's never really shortcuts through behavior change. But I think it's the real thing is like, how do you, it's not necessarily you build up that skill, you build up skills in that area that you want to notice more in, right? Mm-hmm. So it'll naturally happen. But I think the key thing is like, you know, are you structuring your life to include things that are skills where you would be able to notice, right? And I think cooking is a great one. You know, preferably do things that you can create tangibly and that you can share with people, right? So like,
that's why cooking's so great. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, it hits all of them, right? Yeah. It's like, I can create this. Other people can have it, but I can also share it and I can observe them do it. And like, they can notice differences. Like, we can have a conversation about it, and all that helps your assimilation skill, right? Like, you understand every day is like a new experience in terms of that. So endless meaning in terms of what that means. Like, you know, there's thousands and thousands of ways to like get deep into like, oh, but like, this is the theory behind it, and this is like, I taste the palate here, right? Mm-hmm. And I think all those things are really about, like, when you think about, like, I think one of the comparing, and I don't know how, you know, this world of like, you know, people that love wine tasting, right? And then they're like, get so much meaning out of it and get so much pleasure out of it. Like, that's not because they've just read about a lot of wine. Like, it just comes from tasting and developing that palate. So I just think about developing that palate and skill in other aspects of your life. And that allows you to assimilate more and more information about it and get deeper, like more and more assimilation, more and more meaning.
I'm remembering being on a meditation retreat and doing having a raisin, I think it was, that we did. And we spent like 10 minutes just appreciating everything about this raisin, where it came from, all the people that touched it. So by the time you ate this one raisin after 10, 20 minutes of appreciation, how good it tasted.
Yeah.
It was really crazy.
Yeah, that's super interesting. And I wonder if, you know, like, that alone is a great activity, shows that like, just focusing your mind, you can do that. But I, you know, somebody who's worked in like a great farm and a winery who's seen like all the process can like get to that depth of understanding much more, right? So it really goes to like, assimilation ability is something that you can hone in by just like giving it all your attention. But also there is something truly that cannot be replaced in terms of like actually doing, actually being involved, getting your hands dirty, that, you know, like, I think gives you that edge.
Right.
The edge, the meaning edge, sort of.
The meaning edge, yeah. the social part of things you were alluding to with being able to share your food. And then what I picked up then was talking about it with someone. And so and obviously when we do things together with other people, it helps with behavior change. And I would help with your skills here too as well by doing this exercise with other people. Yeah, like talking about your meal, or maybe even going to the, obviously, museum and doing the meaning and detail, seeing what other people notice. In your work, have you seen the social aspect of that part of it? Yeah.
Yeah. That I think that's a super interesting fact, because I think a lot of times when you imagine, like, you know, I start some of my talks this way, where it's that, you know, when you imagine somebody, when you think of art, you think of just one person standing in front of an art piece and contemplating, but it really isn't that. You're always thinking about, you know, what would other people think? You're often there with friends. You're like talking about it. It's a dialogue. And art is just like, and these things are again, information and metaphors, right? So when you find shared metaphors, that's, I think, a profound sort of like the sum is, you know, greater than its parts type of a thing in human cognition, is that
it uplevels you quickly.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like, you and I can look at the same abstract painting and we might have different metaphors that we extract from it, and that connection is likely not going to be as great. Whereas if we did, from the same stimuli, we had the same metaphors that we got out, like, oh, that's so funny you saw that, because I see that too. When you see this color blue or this line, like, it makes me feel this way. Like, that's a shortcut to be able to create social bonding and connection,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to like sitting back and saying like, oh, you know what, like, let's talk about all the times that, you know, this was my childhood and this is that. Like, no, you can just look at an experience together. It could be an abstract painting. It could be just some stimuli. It could be a food that reminds you of the similar same thing. And it allows you to sort of up-level that, that social connection and meaning. And yeah, I think there's really a strong component there because of that compression again, right? It's like what our brain loves more than anything is to get things for cheaper than it could. And
right, efficiency again. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, so it's like when you think about, again, like aesthetics is compression of information. So it's like, oh, if I can learn about you for without having to sit there and like into this, you know, list of things, I can learn about you from like this shared meaning because I have the shared same meaning too. Like I've just gotten this, you know, zip file of uncompressed it for myself, right? So it's meaningful for that reason, basically.
Yeah. The piece I was interested in, I pulled this from your deck, I think, was that people who engage with receptive art activities on a frequent basis had a 31% lower risk of dying independent of demographic, socioeconomic, health-related, behavioral, and social factors. That really is fascinating, that this is actually can help you live longer and live healthier. Can you tell us more about how that works?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was, you know, the effect there was surprised to me as well, because I think you know, oftentimes these things are not measured, right? Because like research is only catching up to this domain, but I think a lot of it goes back to resilience, right? Mm-hmm. So like some of the earlier studies that have to do with the same topic are following students in college when they first started all the way to the end and observing the amount of aesthetic activities that they engaged in and how like incorporated that was as part of their identity and finding that like those that did more so were happier, had better mental health and just were more self-actualized, like were more content with what they had picked. Right. So, and those are all things that we know correlate with better health outcomes, right? Like you're making the right decision. So in like, it's all this, I think you know, sort of, obviously it's hard to know causally, but
right.
My, I guess, conjecture is that it's that component of being able to have, you know, a better outcomes because of that greater self-actualization and, you know, experience with, as opposed to being not having control, right? It's like,
yeah.
So I think it's fascinating in terms of, but also, you know, when you look at just like, there's a whole another world of like, you know, forest bathing and all that stuff, right? That,
yeah.
You know, it's Japan, Israel, they take kindergartners out into the forest and we'll have them just like immerse themselves. And there's really interesting studies now where like maybe just like 3 or 4 hours in nature fundamentally changes how you perceive the world for like a month after. So it's that, you know, exposure to beautiful natural environments, to just like being in those types of environments also just shapes mental well-being, lowers your cortisol levels, right? That's like a strong finding from forest bathing. So I think there's also just that as like a prescription,
right?
It's like, you know, aside from like all of how it shapes how you approach the world and what you do with it, it's just like, it's ultimately also just a prescription, right? Where
right.
like your brain is at ease when it sees something beautiful. I think that's like the biggest thing is like, and when your brain is at ease, it's able to recuperate and process the world better, right? Like it's a signal to you. Beauty is a signal to you that like things are okay.
Yeah.
And not just okay, they're okay enough that you can relax and explore, right? And so the more your life is like that, it's no surprise that, you know, that stress levels, all these things go down because like you're constantly giving your brain that signal.
Right. Oh, that's so fascinating. You said the field, this is called neuroaesthetics, right?
Yes, yeah.
And that, can you say a little bit about that field and how you describe it?
Yeah. I mean, it's when I first started, in my grad studies, like this field was just emerging and this was before the phenomenon, before NeuroGut started adding to everything as a prefix.
Yeah.
So, you know, a little bit early in the game there, but it's essentially aesthetics as a field is actually, I would say aesthetics is the oldest field in psychology. So Gustav Fechner, which is considered by many the father of psychology, like, you know, started this whole field. The fundamental questions that started off there were about preference, about taste, and how that changes, you know, philosophically, these things are as old as time. Questions are as old as time. You know, Plato and Kant talking about, like, what is true taste? What is beauty? Is it defined in material things? Is it defined in subjective things? So that's been going. And then this was a neuroaesthetics part of it, is like, there was this, you know, this ability now that humanity had to be like, oh, we can actually measure people in these experiences finally. So it's been a really interesting development that, you know, we don't have enough time to go into, but it's been a really interesting development of neuroaesthetics being like, how can we understand how our brain reacts differently when things are beautiful, when as opposed to when they're not, right? And processing the same information or more beautiful information, looking at artworks, looking at nature, and tons of studies have been done in terms of, like, you know, heart rate, in terms of people actually being scanned in a fMRI scanner laying down, EEG, and all those are getting at this neuro component. And I think the idea, the output of that is, like, now, which is, like, applied, which is, how can we take this information and you know, understanding that, then promote those mind states, right, basically. Right.
And this is so fascinating. I really could talk about this forever. And now I'm so excited to go home and make dinner tonight and just put so much attention and detail to it. Parents, and I think one of the other things I hear is parents should try to incorporate this aesthetic mindset into kids as early as possible, because obviously all the whole life health outcomes. Is there a parenting portion of this?
There's not work on it, unfortunately. I think it's more so just, like, you know, would have to be, it's anecdotal, but I think in terms of my opinion, like, I have a 3-year-old and I think about it all the time about, like, how can I make, you know, the places that I want her to engage with, like, the more attractive place, like, the more relaxing place. Like, we have a reading corner that you would look at and say, like, oh, that's beautiful, right? Like, as opposed to just, like, it's like, what is it promoting, the mindset that's promoting? So I think you can also I think the key thing though is, like, you can also nurture that mindset in your children, right? So promoting, like, noticing, promoting and just you like in front of them saying, like, look, I like, that's beautiful, or I see this, like, oh, that's nice, right?
So, like, modeling the behavior.
Exactly, modeling the behavior. Yeah.
So what advice would you give to someone who's just starting to understand this topic, aesthetics, for their and the beauty for their behavior change, to help them make the change they want to make in their lives? What, if they're just getting started, how would you advise them?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that you can, and the smallest thing in terms of, you know, like, the most impactful thing, but yet the smallest ask, is pretty much having just, like, a self-reflective, there's studies where people do this, like, a diary study of, like, what did I notice today that was one thing that was beautiful, right? So I think that's I would say is, like, you know, the smallest ask in terms of, and then what probably has the biggest impact, because once you start doing that, like we talked about, it leads to this cycle, but, like, what is one thing that caught your attention enough that you were like, wow, that's beautiful, right? And if it didn't, then think about, like, how you can change your environment or your day where you would say that, right? So, like, if you sat out in front of your desk all day and you just didn't do that, and it's gone to maybe midday, or, you know, you have that reflection period and you're like, oh, I don't think I've really, there's not been one thing that's made me think, ah, oh, that's, wow, that's pretty. Let's go do that right now so that it is, right? Like, let's make it happen if it hasn't happened naturally. And then before you know it, like, your behavior, like, that's a positive reward that you're giving yourself. Like, you're promoting that type of environment and that type of action. So you'll end up being in, fostering that mindset. So I think that's probably, like, the beginner advice, I think.
I love that. I think that's a fantastic place for us to wrap up. Son, if someone's going to try to get in touch with you or learn more about your work, how do you recommend they connect with you?
Yeah, I think the easiest way is probably on LinkedIn. Just reach out to me on LinkedIn, but my email, but I think that's probably very accessible there.
LinkedIn, yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you for your attention today. I really appreciate it.
And thank you for creating this beautiful environment that fosters this conversation.
I love it. All right. Thank you so much. Hey, thanks for tuning into the show. Any information about this week's guest can be found in the show notes, along with other resources for upgrading your own performance and enhancing your well-being. Lastly, if you want to join the Stamina Lab community, head on over to staminalab.io. Until next time, be well.